together, folks, 800-222-9739. Won't you be that person like Miss Rachel making a difference in your community here? So important, the work that she is doing. And through educating children, the future, those that will turn the tide, those that are saying no to all the awful things in life, racism, homophobia, xenophobia, all the kind of hate that protrudes. She is saying no to it. She's teaching children to say no to it. And isn't that wonderful? So as we move into What's at Stake this morning, keep the calls coming for Democracy Now! And for What's at Stake, 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. This is your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to What's at Stake. I love that music. Don't you love it too? When you hear it and you know What's at Stake is getting ready to start. Les McCann and Eddie Harris live at the Montreux Jazz Fest playing Compared to What? And Compared to What is a perfect theme for today's timely topics. Our first guest is Stephen Spaulding of the Brennan Center for Justice. And Mr. Spaulding will walk us through the possibility of an alternate system for selecting and removing, perhaps just as important, maybe more important, Supreme Court justices. A fairer system that would bring an end to unlimited terms and not harm the Constitution. Are unlimited terms a roadblock to justice? Many experts agree that yes, they are. So let's compare the way things are with the way things could be. In the second half hour, my two guests, Executive Director Monique Dixon and Professor Michael Pinard of the University of Maryland Carey Law School of Gibson's Carey Law School's Gibson Banks Center for Racial Justice, will discuss their good work and especially their efforts to save us from the unconstitutional impact of White House executive orders. Yes, compared to what? One type of Supreme Court versus another, less political, more neutral version of the Supreme Court, and constitutional versus unconstitutional action from the White House. That is a very, very interesting comparison indeed. So, WPFW listener, please listen to our experts, and then you tell me whether the comparison matters. Good morning. I'm Robert Gordon. I knew that was going to be the toughest part of this. Sitting in as today's guest host for What's at Stake. It's a first for me, so please be patient. I have three wonderful legal experts as guests today, all from the nonprofit world, which means they seek to use their legal skills and wisdom to produce change for the good. Those sorts of lawyers, all right? All three will discuss very timely topics, topics that, along with everything else happening in today's climate, make my head spin, just like listening to Democracy Now! Does. But we must discuss them. The First Amendment gives us the gateway to action. But please don't get so wrapped up in the conversation that you forget to pull the trigger on your donation to WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. My first guest, Stephen Spaulding, is here to discuss a project and plan to change how Supreme Court justices are appointed and how long they can stay on the court. Mr. Spaulding is managing director in the Kohlberg Center at the Brennan Center for Justice, where he works to realize a fair and inclusive judiciary system that protects fundamental rights, democratic values, and the rule of law. He has extensive experience on Capitol Hill, including as policy director for the Senate Rules Committee, where he advised on election administration, security, voting rights, campaign finance, and artificial intelligence in elections. And that's only a very short version of Mr. Spaulding's resume. So let's get to it. As I see it, the question comes down to, is there a way to impose term limits on justices that does not offend the Constitution? If so, what does it look like? and how do we get it done? Mr. Spaulding will tell us how. Welcome, Mr. Spaulding. How are you this morning?
Good. Thank you for having me, Judge Gordon. Thank you.
Good. Good. Glad that you're here. Why don't you first tell our listeners briefly about the Brennan Center? Tell us what it is, what it does, and what your role there is, please.
Sure. So the Brennan Center is a nonpartisan law and policy institute. We work to reform and revitalize, and especially now, really defend our country's systems of democracy and justice. I think of us, and we talk about ourselves as being sort of three things as part of our overall model. We're a think tank, so we do a lot of rigorous, cutting-edge research to identify problems and craft transformative solutions. One of those that I worked on both as an advocate and on Capitol Hill was around automatic voter registration, for example. That's an idea that the Brennan Center and my colleagues here really honed to say, wait a minute, why put the burden on voters? We should come up with a system of automatic voter registration. That's a type of work that comes out of our think tank arm. We're also an advocacy group, so we fight in court. We work with elected officials at the federal and state level and groups all across the country to advance legislation. And we're also a communications hub, so we also want to win in the court of public opinion. And so we do a lot of public opinion research, messaging research to best articulate our vision and our work to the public.
Well, do you find it hard to walk that tightrope of nonpartisanship in today's world?
You know, I think the values that we are working to uphold are really nonpartisan values. I mean, these are values of freedom, of equality, of equity, of ensuring that people can make their voices heard in our elections. Whether you are a Democrat or a Republican or an independent, you should have a say in the future of our country and in the policies that we elect our representatives to pursue. So I really do think of these as nonpartisan principles. And it's unfortunate that we've seen this sort of asymmetric polarization where we've seen support for a lot of these policies fall along partisan lines. I should say, you know, some of this is also somewhat new. You know, we just passed this week or last week, we just passed the 60th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 being passed by Congress. That was renewed multiple times over those 60 years until the Supreme Court gutted the heart of it in the Shelby County decision. But I like to think about, you know, the last time it was reauthorized was in 2006. It passed the Senate 98-0 and was signed into law by President George W. Bush. I don't have the exact statistics in the House, but it passed like overwhelmingly. So this sort of partisan breakdown is something we have to deal with when it comes to, you know, one party, you know, standing athwart a lot of these values, at least right now. And so we have to keep our eyes on that. I will say there are still like slivers of hope around these things. And what we have to do is really, particularly when we're talking about legislative advocacy, you know, really scour the waterfront, because we know that a lot of these proposals that we are supportive of have wide bipartisan support, one of which is Supreme Court term limits. Like 78% of the public supports them. And so what we have to figure out through our comms work, through our advocacy, and through our think tank work is how do you translate that bipartisan support among the people, the actual people, the voters, to decision makers?
I'm still thinking about that 98-0 and signed in law by a president who back then most would consider very conservative. And I guess those were the days. It wasn't that long ago. So thanks for that.
Yeah, I mean, the other example, for example, is, you know, there was a big fight around changing the role of money in politics. So McCain-Feingold is how it was like referred to 20 some years ago. But John McCain, Senator McCain, and Senator Feingold teamed up to strengthen our laws that protect against the undue influence of corporate money in our elections. You know, that's another strong bipartisan law that passed, and I believe it was 2002, again, signed into law by Bush. What brings, like, the 2006 reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act? What does that have in common with McCain-Feingold? The Supreme Court, in separate 5-4 decisions, gutted those two bipartisan laws. One, Citizens United, gutting a ton of McCain-Feingold, and two, Shelby County, gutting at the heart of the Voting Rights Act.
Mm. Okay. Well, let's get down to cases then, because I know this is the topic that we wanted to discuss today. Let's talk about life tenure on the Supreme Court and whether a justice's time on the court can be limited. I know lay people, when I talk to them about it, they sort of, why do justices and judges really in the federal system get to stay on the court forever? Something, or not forever, but until forever comes for them, I guess, or until they decide to leave the court voluntarily. What's the basis for that? Can you explain why that's the case in a way that our listeners can understand,
yeah, please? Yeah. So generally, the way our system has worked for most federal judges is that they hold, the Constitution says they hold their power so long as they, it's called the Good Behavior Clause in the Constitution. So long as they are operating with quote unquote good behavior, they can hold their office for life. And so, as you said, that leaves it up to a federal judge to decide if and when they're going to leave the bench after they are appointed. So that good behavior,
right? Short of impeachment.
Yeah. Exactly. Short of impeachment and removal, given the good behavior clause, that they can hold office for good behavior, that for life, then they sit on the bench. But it's interesting to note a couple of things. One is, more than 100 years ago, Congress passed a statute that, or a law, that sets up a system for judges to take what's called senior status. And the way that works is, if they have served for a set number of years, I believe it's 15 years, and then reach the age of 65, they can take what's called senior status. They can do a couple of things. They can totally retire and go write and teach and enjoy life, or they could stay on the bench in senior status, again, at the same rate of pay, and have a lighter caseload. They can still sit as a judge. They can still have clerks. But they won't be in what's called active service. So that system's been in place for more than 100 years. The Supreme Court actually upheld that system, when some people might have challenged that to say, well, wait a minute, like, lifetime tenure means you have to work in active service, like, till your dying day, unless you retire. And the court said, no, we can have the system of active service and senior status. One of the proposals that we support is to set up a similar system for the Supreme Court. The only difference is, it would set up a system where a Supreme Court justice, as we envision it, and as others have written about, where there's a pretty strong consensus, the Supreme Court justice would sit for 18 years and then roll into a senior status role. After those 18 years, the senior status justice could hear cases, for example. They wouldn't hear every case. They would no longer be a, quote, active justice, but they would be a senior justice. They would hear cases where there's a recusal. So sometimes if a justice has a conflict, or for whatever ethical reason or other legal reason, can't sit and hear a case,
And they acknowledge the conflict.
And they acknowledge it and explain it. then the senior justice could sit in on that in the case of a recusal, you know, or the senior justice could do what's called, I'll try to stop with all the terminology, but it's called, like, ride circuit. So the way our system is set up for listeners, you've got the district courts, that's the trial courts. Then you've got the appellate courts, the circuit courts. So you'll hear, like, the First Circuit, the Second Circuit, the D.C. Circuit, and then the Supreme Court. For a long time, retired justices have sat on the appellate courts, like, more than 1,300 times. You've had justices who have left the bench, like Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, like the late Justice David Souter, who just passed away and retired, I think, in 2009.
Right.
He went up to his cabin in New Hampshire, but he also sat on lower court decisions. So
And
he
I
was
think he
still working
probably
at the
enjoyed that more than being on the Supreme
lower court.
Court,
Probably.
from what I've
Yeah.
heard, but go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one part. So that's one part is we'd have term limits. So we can get into why that's helpful. But the other important thing about these term limits is it would set up a system where each president would have two and only two appointments to the Supreme Court. So the idea is once this system is set up, every 2 years, a seat would open on the court because the most senior justice who sit 18 years kind of rolls into senior status. So we think that would A, maintain the court's independence because 18 years is still a long time. Our basic premise here is no one should hold too much public power for too long. And one justice who sits on the Supreme Court for decades, there have been some that have sat through nine presidential terms, get to shape the federal law for generations in a way that the people who set up this system that's been interpreted as lifetime appointments, like never necessarily intended. At the time of the like fa at the time that people came up with this idea of, life tenure, people were living for like 15 years. That would be the average, right? Now we have justices that are sitting on the bench for 26 years. There's some that are on the bench now that could serve up to 35 years. I think there's a lot of anticipation that if there is another opening on the court and Donald Trump gets a fourth pick or even a fifth pick, there's an incentive to find someone quite young who could sit there for literally 40 years as life expectancy has grown, and they have the power to shape the court for generations. So 18 years is long enough. It maintains judicial independence, while at the same time, when you set it up and you have these term limits for Supreme Court justices, each president gets two, and so there's some predictability, and the makeup of the Supreme Court is more like a little more tethered to political leadership and to elections.
Now, let me, because when I try and explain this to lay people and they want to know why was it put into the Constitution, I say, well, the framers, and I guess Alexander Hamilton is the one best known for writing about this topic, wanted judges to be free from political pressure. That's key, and it sounds like a beautiful thing, and it makes a lot of sense. And in companion with the other provision of the Constitution, it says their salaries can't be reduced. So there'll be no financial pressure, there'll be no political pressure. And that sounds like a beautiful thing. It always did to me. It sounded that way back in law school, right? So what's wrong with the system now? Can you point out some of the problems that maybe even lay people might not be aware of that really inspires this idea? And we have 3 minutes. I'm sorry, Mr. Spaulding, though.
No, it's fine. But I think a couple of things. What we increasingly see is when you have this much power for this long, there is a perception, and in some cases a reality, in many cases, but there is a perception of unaccountability, being completely unaccountable. And so yes, we have the system of life tenure that was set up to insulate justices, as you said, from political pressure, to ensure that we have fair and impartial courts. But at a time when the court has become increasingly powerful and is affecting everyone's life, we've talked about the freedom to vote, reproductive freedom, the court overturning Roe v. Wade and the Dobbs decision, and in many other ways, giving the president immunity. 2 summers ago, like we or last summer, in Trump v. US. So we have an increasingly powerful court that is showing up in people's lives that is in tension with some basic constitutional values of some accountability and ensuring that the people's voices are reflected and that democratic values, present democratic values are incorporated. And that's not to say that the court is accountable to the voters, but that is to say there has to be a better balance. And one way to do that is to have Supreme Court term limits so that each time there's a vacancy, it is not a scorched earth battle, where the future of our country rises and falls, and the rule of law and this whole body of law rises and falls on the appointment of a single justice. There has to be a continued, what these term limits do is it brings in new perspectives, new voices in a balanced way, and that will hopefully lower the temperature. And we can get into more. I mean, the Supreme Court is an outlier here. It is the only court that gives lifetime appointments to its highest court. No other major constitutional democracy gives life tenure to its justices. And 49 out of the 50 states, 49 out of 50 state Supreme Courts limit the tenure, either of mandatory retirement age or term limits or retention elections.
I want to squeeze in one last quick question. Is there reason to hope that this can happen? And what can people do to help make it happen?
I think there is hope. Look, there are several proposals that have been introduced in Congress. One led by Congressman Hank Johnson, who is the subcommittee ranking member on a Constitution subcommittee of the U.S. Judiciary, House Judiciary Committee. It's a mouthful. There are proposals. Congressman Jamie Raskin, the ranking member, is supportive of it. Senator Whitehouse, who is likely to have the gavel in the Senate if and when the Senate flips, has introduced term limits. He hasn't done it yet this Congress, but last year he had a bill to impose term limits. So there are proposals that have been introduced. It's very popular with the public. A Fox News poll found that 78% of people support Supreme Court term limits, including 68% of Republicans. That is consistent with polling across the board when this has been polled, because people, it was a poll that just came out last week that found that Supreme Court approval just dipped below 40%, which is the lowest in the history of Gallup polling. So there is a serious disconnect between the public and the court. And when you lose trust in the court, that comes close to harming its legitimacy, and it has carry-on effects when it comes to the rule of law. Not to be too hyperbolic about it, but if people do not trust the court, we have a serious problem. And term limits is one way to bring some basic accountability, some regular turnover while preserving judicial independence.
One more reason why voting matters. If you don't think it does, you're wrong. Listen to what Mr. Spaulding said. Take it to heart and use that information to the benefit of all of us. Thanks so much, Mr. Spaulding, for coming. That was wonderful. I really, really appreciate it. I'm sure our listeners do too. Have a great
pleasure
of the day. Sure.
Thank you.
Yep. And now we're going to break for fundraising.
Hi, Robert. Yeah, we don't really break. We just keep it going because the fundraising is an integral part of what you're doing this morning. We're so happy to have you with us, guest hosting for What's at Stake. And you offered a very informative interview and enlightening guest. Thank you so much. And so we're asking our listeners to go to the phones and pledge your support. $500 to go for this hour for What's at Stake, 800-222-9739, or you can go online to WPFWFM.org. And Robert, as you know, WPFW is mandated to come to their listening audience four times a year because Lou Hill, the founder of Pacifica Radio, believed that our listeners would respond to a media outlet that reflected their values. And so that is how we became listener sponsored, predating NPR by 20 years. And we are proud that we are exclusively listener sponsored. There is no corporate nor governmental support. It is the people that power this station, and this show, What's at Stake, holds space for What's at Stake. So again, we ask you to go to the phones right now, 800-222-9739. Or WPFWFM.org. We have $500 to go. We can do this together. And Robert, we have about 36 minutes to make the goal.
Yes, indeed. Can you hear me?
Yes.
You're fine, Verna. Yes.
Okay. This is Verna Avery Brown. I'm the executive producer of What's at Stake. And I just wanted to take a moment to introduce Judge Gordon. to our audience, to our listeners who may not be familiar with him. He's a retired judge, a bankruptcy judge of the District of Maryland, sat on that court for 14 years and has shared some of his wisdom and expertise with our What's at Stake audience in a series of teach-ins on bankruptcy. He's a 1982 University of Maryland Carey Law alumnus, and he's the vice chair of the WPFW Local Station Board. He's relatively new to WPFW and Pacifica, but Pacifica is not new to him. How long have you been listening to Pacifica radio, Judge Gordon?
Since I was a teenager in New York.
So we won't do the math.
Back then. Sorry,
we won't do the math on you.
That's okay. I'm 68 and proud of it.
Okay. So would you say that Pacifica helped inform and shape the person that you are today, Judge Gordon?
There's no question about it. I mean, it's information and points of view that you're not going to get, you know, from many other sources. Well, I'll say this. When I was younger, there were probably a lot more sources of, you know, the information that Pacifica would provide. But Pacifica certainly stood alone in the media, in the radio universe, mm-hmm. in terms of providing that information. I'll tell you, there's always been a personal affinity for me. The band that I was in when I was a teenager, The New Message, we actually appeared on WBAI at one point as guest musicians.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ashford and Simpson were the sit down on the couch guests. We didn't get to sit down on the couch, but there were too many of us for it, that anyway. But yeah, so that's a memory that, you know, stays in the heart. I'll put it like that.
So you
and it's made me a loyal listener and a loyal contributor since
then.
And when I came down here to go to law school, you know, I was pleased to find that there was a Pacifica station in D.C. And have been a listener and a contributor since.
Okay, so what I want to do, I want to challenge any judges, lawyers, prosecutors, law professors, or graduates of the University of Maryland Carey Law School to make a pledge to this program right now to demonstrate your support for this type of well-informed, analytical, expert information we're getting on this show and would like to have continue in this time slot. Judge Gordon gives it to us straight and in layman's terms, not in a bunch of legal ease that only lawyers and judges understand. And as Katia has said, we have a goal to make. And with your help, I know we can do it. The number to call, 202-588-9739. 202-588-9739. One more time, 202-588-9739. Or you can simply use Cash App. And that would be $ WPFWFM. Katia?
That's right, Verna. And we just ask you to be in solidarity with us right now. Some of you may not be able to hear us clearly right now. Unfortunately, there is a challenge with the terrestrial signal. But I know there's also some that are able to hear us. We're not quite sure what's going on, but this is why we want to ensure that WPFW is fortified. Mm-hmm. You know, we have had hackers in the past. We don't know if that's what this is, but we do know that there are forces that want to silence us. Mm-hmm. And we're not letting that happen. So, and we've known that. I mean, that's not a new thing, right? They're not a new thing. You can't speak truth about power and not someone try to silence you. But we ask those that can hear us, whether you're streaming and can hear us beautifully, or you're in an area or you have a certain kind of radio where you can hear us, we ask you to really step up now because you are the ones that can make the difference this morning. Not, you know, don't go to strangers or don't rely on strangers. You do it. You make the difference right now. Pick up the phone and call 800-222-9739. WPFWFM.org to ensure the WPFW can be as fortified as it can be so that programs like What's at Stake, executively produced by Verna Avery Brown and hosted this morning by Judge Robert Gordon, can be heard, that there is space for this. 800-222-9739, $500 to go. We can do this together, folks. Many hands do indeed make light work. And I want to just echo what Verna said and challenge all the judges out there listening, all those that believe that term limits are important for the Supreme Court. I know that's probably from what the statistics we heard, that's a majority of people. So if you understand the critical role that the Supreme Court is playing, has played and will continue to play, and the fact that we want to make sure that it reflects what the people's will is, support independent media, support journalism that's going to bring you all of it, not just a narrative, not omitting facts, but all of it. And that's what What's at Stake does. That's what WPFW does. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. $500 to go. We can do this together, folks, but it takes you.
Thank you, Katia and Verna. And now we're going to turn to our second set of guests. But I want you all to open up your wallets and keep the money flowing in while we do that. Okay. The question for the next two guests that we have today, how do you fight unconstitutional action? Period. I think to put it simple, I think that's what we're going to talk about mainly here. My two guests are Professor Michael Pinard, sorry, Mike, and Director Monique Dixon of the Gibson Bank Center for Race and the Law at University of Maryland Carey Law, which is near and dear to my heart. That's my alma mater, and that's where I'm also teaching now. You know what? In the interest of time, I am going to forego going through the bios because I think we want to have more time to talk about what we're here to talk about. If you want to see their bios, please visit the website. Just take it from me. They are both highly, extremely qualified to opine on the subject that we're talking about. And let me just, before we even get into it, I want to say that the topic that we're going to consider, and it was brought up by Mr. Spaulding during his session, is the Trump versus U.S. opinion. It always clouds my mind in any of these discussions with respect to what's constitutional and what isn't. And that's the decision that held the president is above the law, in my opinion, essentially says he can do anything he wants as long as he's acting in his official capacity without consequence. So if we can address these issues with a background of that in mind, I'd appreciate it. And I'm going to turn it over to you all to talk about the Gibson Bank Center just a little bit before we get into the depth of the what we think might be unconstitutional action. So go ahead. Either one of you who wants to start. Tell us about the Gibson Bank Center.
Well, thank you, Judge Gordon, for the invitation and for this conversation. So just to give a very, very quick background on the Gibson Bank Center for Race and the Law, we have been in existence since September of 2023. We are named after Professors Larry Gibson and Tanya Banks, Maryland Law School. I believe this is our 202nd year in existence. And Larry Gibson and Tanya Banks are the first tenured Black professors at the law school, men and women respectively. And Professor Banks retired a couple of years ago, and Professor Gibson just retired this year. So in these 200 years, the sort of the history of Black tenured professors is very, very recent. So in May of 2020, when George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis, a few of us went to our dean at the time and said that we really need a center for race at the law school, that we were sort of a bit exhausted of sort of having these sort of, panel discussions after every policing strategy that sort of come and go with sort of the moment, and we needed something more sort of sustaining and long lasting. So that's how the center came into being. And it came into being, and at the outset of our of putting the center together, we met with various stakeholders in Maryland and Baltimore to get from them what it is they wanted a center such as this to focus on. And from these meetings, we identified our subject areas that are focused today. And I'm sorry for speaking quickly, but I know we need to get to some conversation. So subject areas are the criminal legal system, economic justice, education, housing, health, voting and redistricting, technology, transportation, and emerging issues. We address these areas through three pillars. One is education and engagement, the other is advocacy, and the last is research. And we engage all of our work in collaboration with community. That is, we want to be seen and felt as a sort of as a collaborator, as an entity that can help support the organizations and individuals who have been doing the work longer than we have.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you'd like to add, Director Dixon?
No, but I'd just like to say good morning to you and good morning to your listeners. And I, too, am an alum of the University of Maryland Carey Law School. So it's very good to be with you this morning and with your listeners.
Great. And I'm going to apologize to you all for kind of, you know, the time crunch. But I think we can get a lot done.
Oh, yeah.
Get to the bottom line. So let's try and do that. The things that I wanted to discuss. And there's a lot that the center does, but the things I wanted to discuss to give really a behind the scenes view for the listeners on battling these executive orders that have been put out by the administration. So it's my understanding that the center was involved in two of these cases, at least one being the birthright citizenship case and the other involving one of the executive orders issued against one of the quote-unquote big law firms. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about birthright citizenship first, if that's okay. And to begin that, you can take it wherever you want the conversation to go. Please give the listeners an idea. This is something that we take for granted, that at this point, maybe we shouldn't. And I want the listeners to understand how important citizenship is to get an understanding of why it's so horrific, the thought of losing it. So give us an idea, please, of what U.S. citizenship means and what goes along with it.
So I'm going to go through a lot very, very quickly, because I do think the executive order dealing with the law firms is really sort of ties in really with the conversation that you had in sort of the last half hour as well about the rule of law and sort of lawyers as pillars, if you will, of the democracy. But in terms of the birthright citizenship executive order, this was issued by the administration on the very first day that it took office. And really what this order says is that this administration does not recognize birthright citizenships to individuals if their mother was unlawfully present. This is a newborn baby. If their mother was unlawfully present in the United States and the father was not a citizen or lawful permanent resident, or when the mother's presence was temporary but lawful, and the father was not a citizen or lawful permanent resident. So we're really talking about children of undocumented immigrants or individuals who are here with a student visa. So citizenship is the cornerstone of the democracy. And actually, that's what was said in the amicus brief that we signed on. So that's actually a quote. And without citizenship comes, first of all, belonging to a state and belonging to a country, but also any number of benefits, whether it's medical benefits, whether it's being able to get a passport, right? Whether it's being able to sort of move about freely in the country, right? So there are all these sort of benefits that we as citizens don't even think about, but our existence would be totally different if we didn't have sort of this blanket of citizenship. So this executive order is a blatant violation of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which says that all persons born in the U.S. are subject to its jurisdiction, are citizens of the U.S. The citizenship clause, and I'm sorry for going fast, remedied Dred Scott, right? 1857 Supreme Court case, which held that Black people were not citizens of the U.S. Supreme Court, subsequent to Dred Scott, held that the 14th Amendment means what it says, that birthright citizenship applies to children born in the U.S. to non-citizen parents. This executive order tries to do away with all of this. And so there were various cases brought all over the country challenging this executive order. One case is in the Ninth Circuit. It involves the states of Washington, Arizona, Illinois, and Oregon. We signed on to an amicus brief authored by the Fred T. Korematsu Center at UC Irvine School of Law. It's another race center, along with some other organizations, to challenge this executive order. It's in support of a case that's challenging the executive order. The brief details some of the ugly history of the government here, restricting citizenship based on race, actually stripping citizenship from individuals. And so I'm really skipping ahead a bit, but while the Ninth Circuit case was being decided, before it was decided, the United States Supreme Court decided Trump versus CASA at the end of June, which involves an injunction, what's called a universal injunction, that was put in place in response to the executive order, essentially pause the executive order across the country. The Supreme Court said that really limited these universal injunctions, sent the cases back to the sort of lower courts. And what has happened in response is that the ACLU filed a nationwide class action. Again, we're really getting into the weeds here, which actually helps block the order as applied to individuals who are part of this class action. And other court justices in the Ninth Circuit actually applied the injunction to what are called state plaintiffs, the states that have sued, because the states have shown that they would be really damaged by this executive order. So that's a really sort of broad landscape of where things are. But the bottom line, Judge Gordon, as you said, is that this is an executive order which is really rooted at the very fabric of our country. One of the things that makes our country really, really special is that anyone born here is supposed to enjoy the benefits of citizenship.
Right. And if the administration is successful in this, what's the worst case scenario? And then we're going to turn to the other executive order. But Michael, you're doing fine. I understand what you're talking about. I'm pretty sure the listeners are too. Right. But I feel your passion, and that's as important as anything else. So
worst case scenario is every baby born in this country to a non-citizen parent will be stateless, will not have a country to belong to, right? They will not be able to get a passport, right? They will not be able to perhaps even enroll in school, right? They literally will be stateless, right? That's one worst case scenario. The other worst case scenario is that even though the executive order says we are only applying this prospectively looking forward to babies who are born 30 days after this executive order, one of the other fears is then we're going to look back, right? Or to all the other individuals who were born in this country, right? They could be 80 years old. Right. Born the non-citizens' parents. And we're going to strip the protections that they've been living with for their entire lives as well. So we cannot overstate the disaster that would take place if this executive order were realized. And, you know, the Supreme Court, by the way, will at some point reach the merits of this executive order. We think the law is very clear that the 14th Amendment should stand. But, you know, we heard from Mr. Spaulding sort of, you know, what this court is about. So we have every right to be incredibly nervous and scared.
Well, if the president's power that the Supreme Court said the president has in the decision from last summer comes square up against the 14th Amendment, what's the outcome? Can the president, and that's a rhetorical question. I'm not asking you, but what could be the outcome? I mean, that's the question that's been bothering me for a long time. If the president can do anything the president wants without consequence, what's that mean for all of us? So anyway, let's turn to the other executive order. I encourage our listeners to go, well, Google. You can go to the White House website and find these executive orders, but if you Google, you'll find them. I encourage you to read them, especially this one that we're going to talk about now with respect to this particular law firm. That the center was involved in that case also. Go ahead, Michael, talk about that. And jump in, Director Dixon.
Yeah, I'll jump in on this one. So just in terms of background, as Professor Pernard shared, the Gibson Bank Center sits in the Maryland Carey Law School, and the mission of the school is to prepare our students to engage and become productive members of the legal profession in Maryland and nationwide. And so part of this preparation is that our school offers our students opportunities to provide pro bono or free legal services to individuals. And the center, the Gibson Bank Center, complements this mission by offering students an opportunity to not represent individuals, but to just do systemic work, looking at policies and how systems and institutions must work together to ensure that everyone has an equal opportunities to various things such as housing and all the other issues that Professor Pernard listed. So with that in mind, we have monitored closely the executive orders that the Trump administration has released this year, and we were very troubled by the executive order released in March that targeted a number of law firms, and including Jenner and Block. And the administration sought, that order sought to punish Jenner and Block, essentially, for representing certain clients and providing pro bono work at, you know, free legal services to certain clients, taking certain political positions, hiring certain people at the firm. These were all things that the Trump administration opposed. And so, not surprisingly, several of the law firms, including Jenner and Block, filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration, arguing that the executive order retaliated against them in violation of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And our censor, you know, understanding the importance of, you know, making sure that our students, once they graduate and enter the bars of various law, various states, that they have the ability to represent individuals, especially those who challenge government conduct. And so we worked with one of our sister law, Race in the Law Centers, to file an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief. We were not parties to the case, Jenner and Block was, but we came in as experts, you know, individuals who could share information with the court that would help the court understand why it was important, you know, should rule in favor of the law firm. And what we did was in our brief was to remind the court, which is the federal court in D.C., that this is not the first time that government officials have tried to stop lawyers from representing clients who challenge government conduct. And we provided several examples, including one from the civil rights movement. That shortly after the U.S. Supreme Court decided Brown versus Board of Education, which held racially segregated schools, were unconstitutional, the state of Virginia passed a number of bills that prevented school desegregation. And one of the bills targeted the NAACP and their lawyers. And because that organization, as many know, brought a number of desegregation cases. And the Supreme Court struck down that particular Virginia law in NAACP versus Button, holding that it was an unconstitutional infringement on the NAACP's freedom of expression and association protected by the First Amendment. So we argued to the district court in DC that, like the court, the Supreme Court in the Button case, that the district court should rule that the executive order violates the Jenner and Block law firm. And in May, that is exactly what the district court held. They held that the executive order is was an unconstitutional act of retaliation. And the court permanently prohibited the administration from enforcing the order. Then in July, the federal government filed a notice to appeal. So the fight continues. But, you know, we're really grateful to our sister center, the Fred Karamatsu Center for Law and Equality at UC Irvine Law School, which helped our center and others to file the amicus brief in that case.
Thanks very much for that extensive and informative explanation. I'm going to ask, are we taking a pause now for fundraising, folks?
Yes. This is Verna Avery Brown, executive producer. I just want to say, you know, I want to invite our listeners. First of all, I want to thank the listeners that have given so far, particularly Joni from Tacoma Park, Maryland, who says that fellow programmer and native New Yorker, she really appreciates Robert Gordon being on the air today. And also from our brother on the LSB, Kamau, good to hear my brother Robert on the air this morning. Many thanks to you and your guests. So this is a very important, but we want to invite all of our listeners to get in on this. We got a little ways to go, and we need your support. If you appreciate the quality of programming that you're getting here and every week on What's at Stake, this is the perfect time to show your appreciation. Judge Gordon is, you know, a longtime listener, and We're very appreciative to have him guest hosting this morning. He is a true jazz and justice comrade, as Joni says. Our hosts throughout the month consist of Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo, Professor Fahima Sek, and myself, Fern Avery Brown. Last week, I interviewed Lev Parnas, the man Trump allegedly hired to go to his home country of Ukraine and dig up some dirt on Hunter Biden. As a recovering MAGAite, he revealed some of the behind-the-scenes workings of the MAGA cult, including its similarity to the mafia and how he ended up drinking the Kool-Aid. Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo has been leading the legal battle to defend our sacred ancestors' burial grounds against greedy developers. And Professor Sek brings us unique interviews from renowned artists and activists alike. So we need you. I urge you, make a pledge right now for all of the hosts of What's at Stake. This is the last week of our summer drive, so you can contribute now on behalf of the entire collective. 202-588-9739. Or again, 202-588-9739. Katia, did you want to join us?
I was just gonna give that 800 number, 800-222-9739. And I want to emphasize the last of Kamau's statement, which is keep dropping knowledge. Keep dropping knowledge. And that is what Robert has been doing this morning. And that's what What's at Stake does every week. So again, the number to call, 800-222-9739, $400 to go. Of course, we have that Black August, Black Liberation Digipack that can be yours for a pledge of $150. It's a downloadable gift, so you'll get it right in your inbox. And it's a gift that keeps on giving because we encourage you to share it with friends, family, neighbors, frenemies, as Malcolm would say, anyone that needs this knowledge. And that is what WPFW is all about. Robert Gordon, Judge Robert Gordon, is certainly dropping knowledge with his guests this morning and really unpacking what the judicial system at that level looks like and feels like and what we're up against. More importantly, giving us the roadmap so we know that what we're up against. His guests are doing that so brilliantly. So please support this good work. 800-222-9739, $400 to go. That DigiPack is for a pledge of $150. So if we have three people picking that up right now, we will be exceeding our goal for this morning, which is what we want to do. And again, we have been having some trouble with our terrestrial air this morning. So if you are one of the lucky ones that can still hear us, that are hearing us, or if you're on the stream, if you're streaming with us, then it's imperative for you to support right now. 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. $400 to go, y'all.
Yes, and so we need your support. Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Robert.
Okay, all right, that's 3 minutes, I think. That was the word. I want to encourage people to look at these executive orders, especially this one with the law firms. I'll just say when I read it, you know, I don't mean to be funny about it, but it reminded me of something out of a comic book or a movie or a James Bond movie, because it was so personalized that it just resonated with that. So I'd like to ask you, Director Dixon, again, in the context, what are your thoughts on the context of Trump versus U.S.? And what that might mean with all the hard work and sweat, blood, and tears that goes into trying to fight this on a legal plane. What, if anything, do you think this all means in that context? Because that's what troubles me the most, I think.
It sends the message that the executive branch is above the law. And so that any actions taken by the executive branch is acceptable. And what I think what's important is for individuals like our center and other lawyers and law firms to continue to underscore the fact that we, in fact, have a rule of law. We have laws, public laws that are in place that were passed by legislative branches, policies passed by agencies that everyone has agreed to follow. And then to the extent that they are not being followed, people should be held accountable, including individuals in the executive branch and other branches of government.
Thank you. That's a great way to square the circle, so to speak. Professor Pinard, is there anything else you'd like to share about anything about the center and its good works?
Well, the center, we believe that we are uniquely positioned to work on these issues. We have affiliated faculty members, about 7 to 8, who are experts in any number of fields, who from constitutional law to technology to criminal law to international human rights, whose work is connected to the center and our mission. We have students who are ready. We have, you know, any number of community partners who are committed to this work. And I do think that's part of the silver lining, is that there are a number of organizations and individuals and communities who are committed to seeing this democracy through.
Thank you both. And I want to say farewell to all three of my guests. That completes this week's What's at Stake. Thank you to the listeners. Thank you to our engineer, Mike Nasella, our executive producer, Verna Avery Brown. And remember, up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. Eve A. Williams. And that was fun. I enjoyed it.
DC Jazz Fest happens August 27th to the 31st with Branford Marsalis, Layla Hathaway, Ron Carter, the String Queens, and more, including citywide concerts from downtown to the wharf. Labor Day weekend. Details at dcjazzfest.org to get your jazz on.
Concoran Dance Company celebrates its 42nd annual National African Dance and Drum Conference, Coming Together as One, on Labor Day weekend from Friday, August 29th to Sunday, August 31st. The conference workshops will take place at the Washington Marriott Capitol Hill and will be taught by 20-plus master dancers and drummers from Senegal, Mali, Guinea, Liberia, and the Republic of Congo. This year's concert performance will take place on Saturday, August 31st at 8 p.m. at Howard University's Crampton Auditorium, and will feature guest artists from across the U.S. and Concoran's company and community class family. Details can be found at www.concoran.org, that's KanKouran.org, or by calling 202-518-1213. WPFW, where we are changing the world, one broadcast and one community event at a time. I'm Jackie Lukeman, chairperson of the Black Alliance for Peace Coordinating Committee, with an editorial. Donald Trump imposed federal control of the Metropolitan Police Department and deployed the National Guard in Washington, D.C. under the pretext of public safety. This follows his March 2025 executive order establishing the Safe and Beautiful Task Force aimed at addressing crime in D.C. and after the Secure D.C. Omnibus Bill was passed, the latest in Democrat crime laws that have devastated marginalized communities, particularly Black, African, working class, and youth. Now Trump goes further and invokes law and order to justify military occupation, militarized domestic occupation that advances as the U.S. and the West deepen their support for the Zionist genocide in Gaza, while they normalize repression of the global masses struggling against and resisting them. We must confront the colonial capitalist structures and oppressive class rule that made all of this possible. We must fight Trump's authoritarianism, but we must also fight Democrat tough-on-crime criminalization of poverty and dissent. And we must fight for a future where safety is not imposed by militarization, but built through structures of popular democracy, peace, social justice, and collective liberation. The Black Alliance for Peace says, end the colonial occupation of Washington, D.C. No justice, no peace, no compromise, no retreat. The full statement can be found at blackallianceforpeace.com/BAP statements. This has been Jackie Lukman, chairperson of the Black Alliance for Peace Coordinating Committee, with an editorial.
Brazilian nonprofit Educarte presents a night of Afro-Brazilian culture with Ile Aie percussion and dance ensemble from Liberdade Salvador, Brazil, celebrating its 50th anniversary with a return to Washington, D.C. on Friday, September 5th, 8 p.m.